In early November 1914, the first Battle of Ypres was in full flow as the Germans tried to take the Ypres salient, and the population of a small village there, St Julien, were ordered by the local authorities to leave their homes and also the village. The inhabitants of the northern and eastern sides of the village could already see the German troops arriving, and as they left, German bullets were zipping around them. About noon, the exodus started from the village towards Ypres or the surrounding villages where people had friends or relatives that lived there and would take them in. Many of these people thought they'd only be away from home for a few days, and they left most of their possessions at home. The following night, the opposing armies engaged in battle, and a return for the people of St Julien to home became absolutely impossible, and many of them didn't return until about 1920. And one of those places that was abandoned is what we now call, or the British call, Pond Farm. It was marked as Pond Farm on their maps because there was actually a couple of ponds within the grounds of this farm. And indeed, those ponds are still there to this very day. Now, the timeline for Pond Farm during World War One was that in the late autumn of 1914, during that first Battle of Ypres, it was the British forces that were there. And in April of 1915, it was the scene, or was part of the scene, of the first gas attack, and Pond Farm was actually the headquarters of the 2nd Canadian Infantry Brigade, but of course they had to fall back. And so therefore, between April 1915 and the end of July 1917, Pond Farm became the headquarters of one of the German units, and in fact, not just Pond Farm, but other farms in the area. The Germans had used all that time to reinforce these bunkers, and underground tunnels were established linking these bunkers together, and they became real fortresses, and very difficult it was going to be for the British to break through. Now, at Pond Farm itself, the Germans had built three large bunkers about 40 metres in length, as well as a number of smaller bunkers and underground tunnels, and they'd used the cellars of the farm buildings themselves to their advantage. Now, on the 22nd of August 1917, during the Third Battle of Ypres, what we call Passchendaele, it was the 2nd 5th Gloucestershire Battalion that was involved in the attack to take Pond Farm. And they did indeed capture it. And of course, these are the scenes that we see in so many photos of the Passchendaele battlefield being flooded at this time. And although they were successful, their casualties that day were quite heavy. Three officers and 16 other ranks were killed, and one officer and 51 other ranks were wounded, with one other rank missing. And so, for this podcast, Tales from the Battlefield by me, Terry Wenham, we made our way to Pond Farm a couple of weeks ago to meet the son of the present-day owners of Pond Farm, a young man called Stinn. And Stinn is no ordinary young man, because for nearly all of his life, he was born in 1988, he's lived in the middle of what was the Passchendaele battlefield, and he's become fascinated by his living surroundings, and he started collecting things that they found on their farm, because every year, of course, they ploughed the fields, objects came to the surface. And it wasn't long before this young teenager, Stinn, was calling himself the bomb collector. And now he's established this wonderful private museum. But again, that's no ordinary museum, because within that museum, a few years ago, I think he said it was 12 years ago, Stinn had the idea of building a replica Mark IV British tank. And that's what he's done. He's now finally finished it. So in this podcast, myself, along with my two Australian guests that I was taking around the battlefields, visited Pond Farm, and Stinn gave us a guided tour, which I've recorded that for this podcast. So here we go. I hope you enjoy listening to the interview. And then at the end of that, we're going to explain what we then did with our Australian guests as we were following in the footsteps of their ancestors that had died on the Ypres salient. So where we are today is at Pond Farm near St Julien on the Ypres salient. What are we doing here? Why is the reason why we come to see you?
Well, I live here in the middle of the front here in Ypres. We live just between Passchendaele, we live between Ypres and the Menin Roads and Boozing along a mark. And that's the reason why I have a bit of no dove control hobby, because I'm we are finding a lot of stuff here on the field just by plowing it. It comes up by itself, and that's the reason why I have a collection that I'm gonna show you.
I think collection is one of the most understated statements I've ever heard when you say collection, after we see as we go around the museum what's here. And we're not here on our own, because we've got two visitors that have come all the way from Melbourne in Australia to see what Stin has got here and what he's got to show us. So where do we start then? What have you got?
I always start here on my round table on the terrace. I made the table all with 18-pounder British shells, and I could make that in about 2 years time.
Okay.
It's easy for us, we just find it for free in the field, so why not building a nice place?
Yeah.
And my table is the center of the front.
Right.
If you are standing there and you look around, that's the most efficient place to be. Yeah.
So Stin, are these live shells?
These are all empty shells, of course, luckily. We collect all the live shells in a cage.
Yep.
For safety, then you can have a look. But these are all safe, of course.
Yeah.
And the table is made all with small artifacts, like pieces of a rum jar, shrapnel balls, bullets, all the little stuff that we find in the field, just with the eye.
Which is not evident when you look at it, but it's absolutely incredible. You can see the small 303 Lee Enfield bullets that are there, and the small shrapnel balls that were packed inside these shrapnel shells.
And this is your our cage with all the live ammunition.
So what we've got here is, it looks like a rabbit hutch, really. It's got wire around it, and it's got two heavy slabs on top. And inside there, what have we got then? What have we got?
We have some Mills grenades. We have some German gas shells. We have some French fuses, even, what is rare to find here in the area. Bayonets, that's not dangerous, of course, but when it's raining, then it washes off itself, and then it's easier for me to clean it. That's the reason why it's all outside in the cage. That's a British shell that my mom hits with the plow. Luckily, there's a protection cap on it, because...
Hang on a minute, we need to explain exactly what you just said. So that's a British shell. Do we know what type of shell that is?
It's a 4-inch and a half, and it's with the impact fuse. But luckily, there's a little protection cap on it, and if it's without it and you hit it with the plow, then happens. Yeah,
that's one of the heavy shells then.
That's a heavier shell indeed,
fired by a howitzer.
Yes.
During the Battle of Passchendaele. And what you said just then stunned me. You said your mum hit it with the plow.
And that was not good for her heart.
No.
but it happened all the time, and every 10 years you have an explosion, and it happens.
Yeah.
It's not that it's not dangerous anymore. The blue clay protects all the shells, and that's the reason why they still can explode. Yeah.
And what happens to all of this ordnance then? Does someone come and collect it and take it away?
First, in season time, we collect all the shells here in the cage. And it's in a cage of Faraday, so if the lightning hits it, then the electricity will go around it.
Okay.
And then by the time we call the bomb disposal and the police, and then they come and pick it up.
Right.
Yeah. Because we find them almost every week. They fired 300 million shells in the war, and 30% didn't go off. And it's a very small area in here, and that's the reason why we find it all the time.
So say that again, we're looking at a field that's just grass surrounded by crops. Why is that? Why is that? You said that this field has never been farmed?
The grass field has never been farmed because there are too many shells in it. After the war, the farm was on that spot, and after the war everything was destroyed, so they had to build the farm 100 meters backwards, and that place was bombed all the time. It was a German headquarters in that time, and we find lots of unfired shells as unexploded shells. It's a good spot for me to search with my metal detector, but it's almost impossible. Yeah. It says toot-toot-toot all the time, and it's impossible to dig it up. Yeah, and it's too dangerous to plow it because there are foundations of bunkers in the grass field. We have all the metal, all the shells. It's not good for the tires and all like that. We only use it for the cows. We didn't saw one flying yet, eh? But it's yeah, it's original, and you can see it. It goes up and down. Yes. Yeah.
So we've got here we've got a real pile of debris, really. What are we looking at here?
That's all the metal scrap that you find on the field, yeah, because it's everywhere. You can't ignore it. It's not good for the machines, the flat tires. Yeah, then my father says damn, and then I say yes. But yeah, it's not that fun if you are farming here in the field and you have damage on your machines. It's not that good, and that's the reason why we collect it a little bit. Even the thing in the middle here, that's a foot piece of an anti-aircraft. I'm still missing the machine gun for it, but it's a concrete foot piece for it. Yeah.
So that's a German structure?
That's a German structure, yeah. It's very rare to find, and it's from my neighbor, and he drove his whole life around it, but suddenly he was tired to drive in circles, and he said, "Stay, look, you can have it."
You have it.
Okay. Yeah.
He thought of you rather than anybody else in the area.
Yeah, indeed.
I wonder why.
Oh, I'm collecting since my 12 years.
Okay.
Now I'm 34, so it's 22
years. 22 years worth of collection.
Yeah, indeed. Okay. Yeah, and we're still finding stuff. Yeah. Yeah, and it's also how stronger the winters, how more metal is rising up, because the metal is wet, the water turns into ice, it swells up, and then because of the pressure, it comes up. And that's the reason why we still find more than before.
Okay.
Yeah, even the bigger shells were deeper in the ground, and now they are coming up.
Rising to the surface.
Yeah.
And how long do we think this will continue for, what we call the iron harvest?
I think almost forever, yeah. You can't clean it all. There's everywhere, there's a spot. So, yeah, impossible. Yeah, now we collect, I think, around 100 tons of ammunition and metal in a year, yeah, in total in Flanders. Yeah.
Not just on your farm?
No. Yeah.
So we're now looking at a piece of art. I would say this is a piece of art, and it says Pond Farm on it, General Arthur Currie, and there's another name there. Describe this. What am I looking at, Stin?
Well, in the end of 14, the Germans arrived here. Eh? Then 15, then we had a Canadian headquarter here.
Yeah.
And that was by Arthur Currie. He was here on the farm. He had his own headquarters here.
So the famous General Arthur Currie was here in 1917?
Yes.
Wow.
And there's a story that he had to run away and that he went out of a window to run from the buildings, yeah, because of all the explosions.
Because they were being shelled.
Yeah. And then after the Canadians, we had 2 years Germans on the farm, and then they built the farm full with bunkers. We had 38 bunkers in total. They had the time to do it.
Oh, so Currie was here in 1915, so this is the gas attack.
That's the gas attack.
He's escaped in 1915. First. Then the Germans have come in, and then this is behind the German lines, German headquarters for 2 years until Battle of Passchendaele, Third Battle of Ypres, in the summer of 1917. That's the history.
And then General Graf von Hasler, he had his own headquarters here on the farm, and it was so strong. Yeah, the biggest bunker was 60 meters long.
60 meters?
60 meters, and that's the reason why they used the Mark IV tanks on 31 July in 1917 to conquer Pond Farm. But it took them, a month to do that.
Yes.
So the 31st of July 1917, when we come across the Pilcombe Ridge, we've not got this far then on that day, have we?
Yeah.
It's taken another month, did
another
you say,
month,
before we get this far.
August was conquered, Pond Farm was conquered. The end of August, something like that.
And then was lost again to the Germans in the spring of 1918?
Yes, they played a little bit of cat and dog game. They went forwards and backwards, and sometimes it's difficult to know where they all were,
So what we're looking at now is modern barbed wire that's used for agricultural purposes, but your family have used the steel picket. pickets to hold up the barbed wire, just as both sides did in the First World War.
Yeah, indeed, they tried to reuse everything what they find, and especially the screw pickets. They are easy to use, easy to handle, and you can see the difference. The one with the point is German, and the one without the point is British.
Ah, right.
And they were both made in Sweden.
Yeah.
Yeah. They were neutral, and they made it for both sides.
Yeah.
Okay. And with that money, they could start building the Saab cars after the war. Yeah. That's where it comes from. And in the beginning of the war, the screw pickets were quite thick and strong, and it's those that we use. Yeah. At the end of the war, they were thinner because they had less money and
So the idea of these screw pickets, for anyone that hasn't seen them, is that at the start of the war they were using wooden stakes, and your wiring party would go out into no man's land during the night and hammer the wooden stakes into the ground with a hammer. Obviously the enemy would hear that, opened up their machine gun fire, no more wiring party, and then someone had the idea of basically what is a very large corkscrew, and they screw that into the ground silently, and therefore it saved almost overnight hundreds of thousands of lives. Is that right?
That's right, yeah. It has also the name of the silent picket, because in the war it was impossible to smash with a hammer on a pole, that would be too noisy. That's the reason why they invented that. If you put a stick in it, you can twist it in the ground, and that's less noisy. And even in the dark, when they were lost, they just had to fell on the screw pickets, and if they fell the sharp one, by example, then they knew where they were. Yeah, that's the reason.
Huh. That's amazing, isn't it? I knew the story of the pickets, but I didn't realise the difference between the German one and the British one. So you always learn something every day.
So the German one was there.
So now what we're looking at is one of the enormous concrete reinforced bunkers that between 1915 and 1917. German thousands of them they built across the battlefield here, and this is one of them that I believe your granddad tried to blow it up, didn't he?
Yeah, because he didn't want to have a German bunker on his farm. He had 38 bunkers in total, so that took too much of his land, and he said, oh, I'm gonna blow them all up. And this piece is still here because the barn was cracking. There's a big crack over there in the wall. Also, the basement was cracking inside the house, and because of my grandmother, she said, oh, you have to stop, too many cracks everywhere, and that's the reason why it's still here. And now, because of Corona, I digged it up. I had the time, because I had no visitors, so I had the time to dig it up, and now people can go inside to have a look.
Yeah. We can go inside this concrete bunker, and I think last time I came, you told me that this... what looks like a fairly small structure, it's not as big as it was, but how many men could be housed in this small bunker?
Well, it was a bunker of 25 meters, so the bunker came to the trees over there.
Yeah.
And it had five different rooms, and one room was for 60 soldiers, so they could put 300 soldiers in that complex, in that bunker. Yeah. And it was a shelter, so it was just with body heat that they could warm up the room.
I'm going to walk down there and try and describe how it feels. So the first thing I notice is that you put some modern steps in, but I can also see a pipe leading out there, a yellowish pipe. Why is that pipe there?
I can't keep it dry because of the explosions. There are cracks everywhere, even in the floor and in the wall, and I can't keep it dry. It's impossible. Yeah.
So this just shows, as we go down these steps, there's water, my feet. There's some wooden. Are they wooden duckboards?
No. It's made from concrete. It's concrete.
Concrete, just what, a couple of inches?
It's a fake floor, so the water can stay below it.
But at a couple of inches below my feet, below these concrete duckboards, is the water table.
Yeah.
Yeah. And there's photographs here on the wall. Original photographs showing the German soldiers inside this very bunker. And as I go in to the bunker, you can hear the echoes. It's dark, it's got corrugated iron, it's reinforced with corrugated iron, and it's a very eerie experience, to be honest. And you think that so many men would have been in here and this was no doubt used as a dressing station as well by the British as the battle moved on. It really is an eerie experience. You can also see where the water's been, can't you? Where the water has come halfway up the dugout. Is that where the water table is?
That's where the water table is, and that's also my grandfather. He used it to collect all the water from the manure from his cows. Yeah, that was the most easiest thing to do, and the bunker was good to fill up with water, so yeah, septic tank. Yeah.
Right.
And what's that?
That's a stove, so I tried to put everything back on its original place. It's not an original one, yeah. But I found an original photograph, and that's why I wanted to have the same.
So the Germans had their own stove down here for cooking?
Yes, yeah, indeed. In every room they had a stove.
In every room?
Yeah.
And what sort of things would they cook? Do we know? Yeah. Sausages?
I think so. Almost everything what they could find, I think. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's really good.
That is really good.
Especially when you look in their faces.
Yeah, that's... That's a ghost picture that I made. Yeah, I found another on the inside of the bunker. That was the most.
So we're still in this dugout, and we were just. It's a very small. What size do you think it was? Two meters.
Yeah,
two, 3 meters.
Yeah.
Across and maybe 6 meters long, possibly. And when they're under attack, we think that there could be up to 60 German soldiers sheltering here. What was their biggest fear? What's the worst thing that could happen?
The biggest fear was if a shell hits the bunker on the top, just on the roof, that you have a lot of air pressure. And now when you are talking here inside, you can hear the noise, and that wasn't good for their ears. So they had a lot of problems with their ears after an explosion. And the air pressure, if a shell is too big, then soldiers could implode just because of that.
So what we mean by that is that their internal organs would rupture, and they would die of concussion. So when they found these bodies, they didn't have a mark on them, did they, on the outside?
Yeah, indeed. Yeah. And the soldiers, they did not always die because of shrapnel. The biggest problem was the implosion, the air pressure. Yeah, the bigger the shells, the bigger the problem. Yeah.
So we're now walking through the farmyard, and anyone who's been to Pond Farm will be familiar with Charlie the dog, who, as long as I've been coming here for 10 years or so, has been barking his head off like he is today at anybody he sees. And we're just about now to walk into what looks like a modern barn. And as we walk through into this barn, I'm faced with a replica British Mark IV tank, which I hadn't told our Australian guests that this is what they were going to see, because I wanted it to be a surprise. What do you think to this?
I can't believe it. That's crazy.
That's amazing. Unbelievable.
No, I wasn't expecting that to be hiding in this shed.
No.
That's for sure.
Incredible.
So, Sten, tell us about this structure. What made you wake up one morning and think to myself, I'm going to build a British Mark IV tank? When did you have this idea? What made you have this idea, and when did it happen?
Well, I told you it's an out-of-control hobby. It's a project of 20 years, and I had an old school teacher who is an engineer, and he knew I was starting my collection in that time, because I'm finding all the stuff in here. I even found original tank parts on the farm. And we were chatting with each other and said, why would we not build a Mark IV replica tank? Then the tanks would blow up everywhere into pieces. And a female tank, they only had ammunition with them, bullets. So that was less dangerous. And they could drive in couple. Yeah, and that's the reason why you have a male and a female. But you can have both. You can change the sponsons when you want.
On your replica tank?
We had 9 soldiers inside, so you had 2 of them on the front to steer, you had 2 of them on the back to give gas, and they had to talk with each other, but there was an engine in the middle, so they had to give signs to each other. And so there was a lot of noise. They had wooden sticks in their ears for all that. And then you had two people on the left and two people on the right to fire the machine guns or the six-pounder cannons. And then you had one extra commander in the middle with the periscope to look where they had to drive to.
To navigate. And what would happen if the seven men were inside one of these tanks and it got hit by a machine gun fire? Would they be safe?
For a machine gun, yes. An anti-tank gun, no. Even grenades, no. They weren't safe because the thickest plate is 12 millimeters. Yeah, you can't compare that thickness now with the modern tanks of now. It's.
So would a hand grenade or a shell, would it pierce the casing of the tank then?
It would not pierce immediately, but they had a lot of splinters inside, and all the metal splinters flew around.
And they'd be hot splinters.
A hot splinter indeed, and then they had special masks to protect their faces with a sort of splatter mask with the malium colder. But they could not see where they were driving to, so yeah, it was a hell to be inside of such a tank.
Very claustrophobic as well, and hot.
Very hot, very noisy, even all the fumes were inside. In the beginning they thought, it would be nice to drive with the tank in the front, we're going to win that. But it's, no.
So, is this tank just sit here, or do you actually drive it around? What do you do with it?
Well, now we drive it around, so I can steer it with the remote control, it's quite easy. And I can drive it on a low loader, and then we can go everywhere where we want. And now, in a month, we are going to the Great Dorset Steam Fair in England.
You're taking this tank to England, to the Steam Fair in Dorset?
Yeah.
So people can come down to Dorset and come and see it?
Yeah.
And when is this exactly? Can you remember?
This is between 25 August and 29 August.
So it sounds like a bank holiday weekend to me.
Yeah.
In England, bank holiday weekend. So if you're interested in coming to meet Stan and the tank, then get down to the Dorset Steam Fair at that period and you'll give them a guided tour, won't you, of the tank. Is it actually going to be, you're going to drive it when you're there?
People can go inside to have a look in the tank, and then you're going to drive it a few times in a day so that people can see it, yeah.
You can't see his face on the podcast, but your face is lighting up when you think about it. Because you've done this before, haven't you? You did it a few years ago before lockdown.
Well, we went 2 years ago, but now we are finishing the tank to go to Dorset. And that's the main reason why we are finishing. And it's quite hard work to finish it now, because we are working on it now for 100 hours in a month.
Right.
Yeah, and now it's the last month, and hopefully we will...
Because it's not just you, it's your mates as well, isn't it?
Well, I'm building it together even with my father.
So, your dad?
Yeah, I'm installing everything, and my dad does do all the welding. And then we paint it with friends, and yeah. It's a lot of fun, but it's hard work.
Oh my God.
So we've now walked into another small barn, which I don't really know how to describe it. It's a treasure trove, really, isn't it? It's your private museum. What have we got in here?
This is the first house that was built after the war. So it's built in 1921. So now it's more than 100 years old. And that's the reason why I have here my collection. And everything you see is since my 12. Yeah. Just because we find all that stuff in the field for free. And I could not ignore it. So
So I can see a boot on the wall. I can see a French helmet. And that tells us that the French, of course, were here in 1914.
Yeah.
I can see an original wooden pond farm sign.
It's not original, but it's a good lookalike.
Lots of corrugated iron. And on the wall, you've got patterns of all sorts of different bayonets. You've got original maps and photographs.
Lubricants, rum jars. Even my metal detectors hanging on the wall. These are rum jars. It was filled up with straw rum. And it was almost 80 degrees strong. And one jar was for 65 soldiers. And that was to Yeah, to drink, to start the courage, to start the fight. Yeah.
So they'd be given a teaspoon of this before they went into action, or mixed up with their tea or something.
Yeah, indeed. Yeah, it was
an officer's job was to give that to the men.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then there's some wooden steps that go up to the next part of the Sin's private museum. And it says, welcome on each step, welcome to the pond farm. And then we walk up some dock boards, which no doubt you've built.
Yeah, indeed. <yeah. laughs>
And John nearly falls over.
Nearly went there.
Be careful.
Yeah.
That's one of my... one of my rarest things I ever found. That's a
trench mortar.
Trench mortar, a minewerfer. It's German, it's been sabotaged by the French. There's a French shell in it. It exploded, but it was the wrong shape. So the shell stayed in it. And
that's how you found it?
Yeah.
You found it like that?
Yeah. Here in the area. This is also a periscope frame connected with an Enfield. So they had a mirror here to look above a trench, and if you pull on this lever, then this thing goes up, and then you can fire the Enfield without watching over the trench here.
Still got the wooden barrel in fairly good condition, isn't it?
Yeah, just because of the blue clay, everything is preserved.
It's been preserved by the blue clay.
Yeah.
Some very steep steps here, guys. Do you need a hand, John, at your age?
No, no.
He's getting on a bit. He's 60.
Congratulations.
You all made it this long.
So we've now come in to the ground floor. We've come in on the first floor, really, and gone downstairs. And there's an incredible... What, is that a painting on the wall?
That's a painting of a Belgian artist. He made it with an original photograph. And you can see two tanks that were stuck here in our field. So you can see all the shell craters. So it was impossible to drive around it for them. Yeah.
And above that is some the trench boards.
That's an original duckboard that we found 20 years ago. But now I can't find it anymore. Now all the woods... has been rotten, so it's impossible to find something like that again.
Of course.
Yeah.
And then we're completely surrounded then by the debris. There's everything you can possibly think of. There's buckets full of shrapnel balls. There's all sorts of different shells. What's that?
That's a Belgian stove for making waffles. So this was a very old house, and there was a wall here in the middle, and that was the kitchen over there, and here on the left side was the living room. And they all sat around that stove to have it warm and cozy, and they could warm up their pancakes or their waffles or even their irons over there. And then in the Second World War, the Germans took it over here again, and then they used this house, and they used even that stove over there on that spot. And that's the reason why I really wanted to have my collection in this house. Just because of the good story, yeah.
Because somebody lived here.
Somebody lived here, yeah.
This was their home.
Yeah.
I think this is where it gets really personal as well for me, because on your bottom, almost bottom shelf there, we've got boots that men soldiers wore. Do we know whether they're French, British, German boots?
Well, that's quite easy, because on the backside, on the heel, there's metal on it. And then I know it's German. Yeah, that was just to have a lot of noise... when they were coming over, and we still find lots of boots in the field, still coming up.
I wonder what happened to the men that were wearing those boots. Do we know?
Yeah, we can't know. Yeah, sometimes you need to find first a dog tag or something to know who it was. It's almost impossible, because they had the dog tags at the end of the war. Yeah.
And then we got lots of water bottles, different shapes and sizes, and then on the top shelf, we've got all sorts of jars, glass jars, and one of them's got original HP sauce on it. Tell us about that.
Yeah, we still find them in the field, and it has still the same shape as the bottle of now. Yeah, just like the bottles of Schweppes, by example,
We find everything. That was a blue bottle. That was typically for poison. The brown bottles were more.
Why would they have poison? Medicine. Why would they have poison?
When the British were taking over again, the Germans put it quite fast, some poison in the water, and if the British
drunk it, booby trap.
It was a sort of a booby trap indeed, yeah. Yeah, they were quite clever and all that. Yeah.
And within one at my feet, I'm looking at some shell case. It looks like spaghetti in there. What's that?
Well, that's a shell case of an 18-pound shell. So you need to have a big burst in the cannon before the shell would fly out of the cannon. And that's because of that. Now it's spaghetti, but it's a lookalike of the real cordite that was inside. But I can explain you how it works. It's quite easy. And so they put the complete thing in the cannon. The cannon hits the shell case. Then my spaghetti or the cordite is burning. Then because of the pressure, the shell case falls on the ground. The shell flies through the barrel of the cannon. It's rotating because of the drive band. And something that rotates flies a lot further and a lot preciser.
Okay.
And then you have here the fuse. That was a very important thing because the shrapnel shell was filled up with more than 100 shrapnel balls. Those like shrapnel balls. And that needed to explode just before it hits the ground. That's the reason why you have a fuse with a timer on it. I can open it for you. And so when the shell is rotating, a little flame is starting because of a friction stone. And every ring is filled up with black powder. That flame turns around, it goes to that hole, going to the other one, turns around again. And that's the time that the flame needs to go from the one to the other. And then you can set the time there to put the holes further from each other. And then you can set the time on maximum 30 seconds. It was always different that because of the wind or the rain. That's how they set it the time. And when the shell is flying in the flame, goes into the ignition tube, goes down. Here you have the powder chamber, and that thing explodes. And because of the pressure, 180 shrapnel balls fly out just before it hits the ground. So it will have more effect. It will fly more than a kilometer around here in the area. And a shrapnel ball was to wound a soldier, not to kill him, because if you wound a soldier needed six other soldiers to get him away from the front. And that's the reason of the shrapnel one.
Oh. And it's not just that, it's not just the shrapnel balls, the actual shell itself breaks into segments and becomes shrapnel?
Not this one. The shell, the case will stay intact. That's the reason why I could make my table over there.
Right.
You have also a high explosive shell. And those are filled up with black powder. They explode by impact. You create a big flame inside, a lot of pressure, and then it explodes, and then all the metal flies around. But that was more to damage the bunkers and the houses and all like that.
Yeah.
The shrapnel one was more for the soldiers. Was more personal, yeah. Yeah.
Well, you got a bugle?
Those are barn finds. Yeah, sometimes you find stuff on the attic. Even more from Second World War than, by example.
So the Germans, of course, came here in World War II.
Yeah.
And was your grandparents here then?
They were here then, and then they had to sleep in the bunkers from the First World War. They slept even on skeletons.
Because the German officers had requisitioned the farm buildings?
Yeah, indeed, And then they slept here on the attics and all like that.
And that was for 4 years?
Well, I don't know exactly for how long.
Yeah,
I don't know. But they were here, and they left a lot of stuff here behind on the attics, and that's in that corner over there, little pots and
signs of people living, isn't it? That's all it is. What are you going to do in the future here?
Well,
you can't ever move out, can you?
I hope to extend the barn.
Yeah.
And maybe to make a sort of a tank place with my unditching beams, with the original tank. I have original pieces here in the museum as well, so I can extend in the future. And that's my hope to do.
but it needs to stay a hobby. I like to do it as a hobby, not as a job. It's a good thing to
That's
do.
That's what I always say about guiding.
Yeah.
You know, we get income from other ways to you know, live our lives. And I think it's if it's a hobby, it's much more enjoyable than being a job, isn't it?
Indeed.
And we haven't got the same pressure as well. It's a wonderful hobby to have, isn't it? One that's consumed your life.
It's great to do because I met a lot of people, and especially about the history. Because I have a lot of visitors who say, oh, my grandfather is still missing here on the farm. I have his diary with him, from him. And yeah, he's somewhere over there in the field. But yeah. And then I have here my my tree. And then they sign my tree with the name of the missing soldier. Sometimes people are crying. Yeah, sometimes it's emotional. Yeah.
So that becomes a memorial in itself, doesn't it? Your tree that you've got there. How many, I know obviously we've had the lockdown, but how many people did you have coming here? Do you think you have coming here in the course of a year? Where do they come from?
Well, before COVID, I had almost 2,000 people in a year. And they come from everywhere. Yeah, even from Russia.
Not anymore.
Not anymore. But yeah, Australia, and the most visitors came from Canada.
Really?
Yeah, because of the headquarters of Curry. Curry. Yeah.
What about German people?
Not in the beginning, but now they are coming over.
That's good
and
news.
It's more the younger generation who are getting the interest to come over.
That's good news, isn't it?
It's very good news.
It's very good news. Yeah. They want to learn about what happened and where their ancestors lived in the same way that we do. They want to know in the same way, don't they? So I think that is good news. And things are now picking up again. Now you're starting to see coach parties come again.
Yeah, more and more. So I hope it will come back just as before Corona. Let's cross the fingers.
I'm sure it will. Well, thank you very much for that. I'm really, really grateful, and we'll keep in touch so we can see what progress you make. And don't forget, if people are around the bank holiday weekend, to get down to the Dorset Steam Fair and see the tank in action, really.
No problem, everyone is welcome.
So, as I've mentioned, this tour was guiding Michael and Susan Wyatt, who'd come all the way from Melbourne in Australia to follow in the footsteps of their two relatives. And Michael's relative, he only found out a few weeks before the trip that he even existed. And he was a soldier that was called Private Henry Robert Osborne, and he was serving in the 1st 7th Battalion of the Middlesex Regiment when they went into battle on the 16th of August 1917 in what was to become known as the Battle of Langemarck. It was the second stage of the Third Battle of Ypres, or the Battle of Passchendaele as we know it. Now, Henry was a young man who'd come from Clacton in East London, and he joined up in March of 1915. And in September 1916, he arrived on the Western Front. And what happened to him? That by looking at the battalion diary of his battalion, the Middlesex, that day, we can see that they were involved in an attack from the Westhoke Ridge, which is near the Menin Road, near Ypres, and they were attacking towards Glencorse Wood. And the battalion diary tells us what happens. It said, at August 16th at 4:45 a.m, 5th Army attacked, and it went well at the start. An advance of some 800 yards was made along the divisional front, while it was reported that the 25th Brigade on the left had captured Iron Cross Redoubt. At 7:30, D Company was sent off to carry small arms, ammunition and bombs from the Menin Road to the West Oak Ridge, and they returned at 10 a.m. At 8:30 a.m, a company was ordered forward to support the attack, and D Company followed at 10:45 a.m. And then it goes on to explain what really went wrong. Information was received that our troops were back in our original front line. The enemy barrage had been particularly heavy since 0 hour and had caught the rear waves of the advancing battalions, so that the leading troops had to retire under pressure of enemy counterattacks. The battalion was ordered onto the West Oak Ridge and ordered to hold it at all costs, but the suspected counterattack did not develop. Now, what we know is that because of the rain in August of 1917, they'd run into mud that was 5 foot deep and about 30 yards across. It was eventually established that 25 men from the battalion were killed that day, including Henry. Like him, 19 of them have no known grave, and they're remembered on the Tynecott Memorial, which Michael visited shortly after we'd been to the battlefield. Now, two of the other six that do have a grave are buried in Tynecott, so it's possible, it's only possible, we just don't know, that maybe, just maybe, Henry's also buried in Tynecott under one of the unknown headstones. As for Susan's relative, well, he was called Rifleman William Henry Wallace, and he was serving with the 2nd Battalion of the Royal Irish Rifles, and they were probably in one of the most dangerous places in the world in May 1915, and that was at Hill 60, just to the south of Ypres. And what do we know about him? Well, his service record was one of those that was destroyed in the Blitz in 1940, and we do know that his battalion went on to Hill 60 in early May of 1915. And as we know, during April and the early part of May, Hill 60 was a scene of awful fighting, gas warfare, mine warfare, hand-to-hand fighting. And it was during this fighting on the 9th of May that young William was killed. The battalion diary tells us that on that day, they were actually holding part of a trench, Trench 46, that was also held by the Germans. There was a barricade in the middle, but they were subjected to rifle and shell fire. And 14 men died that day, including William. The other 13 have no known grave. William was initially buried in a field cemetery, and then after the war, his body was exhumed and reburied in Spoilbank Cemetery, which is only about a mile away from where he died. And that was in the early 1920s. And how did they identify, how did they know that when they found that temporary grave in the early 1920s that it was his? Well, it actually had a wooden cross that had been placed on the temporary grave. And on that cross, his details were recorded, and they also found some identification on his clothing. And that allowed him to have a permanent resting place in Spoilbank Cemetery that Susan could visit. She'd visited once before, but she could visit and pay her respects. As always, it was a highly emotional experience for me and Michael and Susan to take them not just to the place of memory, or in William's case, his grave, but actually to stand on Hill 60 and on the West Oak Ridge where their two relatives died. And when we finished our tour, we were in the Ypres Reservoir Cemetery. We'd looked at some of the notable stories there. And then I asked Michael and Susan to try and articulate their thoughts of what this tour had meant to them. And their response was highly emotional. So we spent the last 3 or 4 days touring the battlefields with Michael and Susan Wyatt, that have come all the way from Melbourne in Australia on the trail of their relatives. And what has it meant to you then, Michael? This is something you said you'd been interested in, and it was only a few weeks ago that you found out that you'd got a relative that died at Passchendaele. Tell us about your story.
Well, this is something that has interested me since I was 10 or 11 years old. And at that time, until only as recently as 7 or 8 years ago, I didn't even know we had a relative on Susan's side of the family that had actually served and had been killed. It was just, I'm interested in all of them in one sense. But then to find out only in April that I myself had an ancestor that was killed and is memorialised out at Tynecott adds another personal layer to it all. But you know, I can't help, we're sitting here in this cemetery now, and you just can't help but think about all of the people that are represented, you know, and just here in this small corner, there's so many stories, so many men that didn't have the opportunity to live the life that we have.
I think it really brought it home for me. We're in Ypres Reservoir Cemetery, which many people will know, and there's all sorts of stories in here. There's a Victoria Cross winner. We've got at least two sets of brothers that we've talked about, two brothers that had come from Australia. There's also 3 Shot at Dawns here. There's a real mixture of graves in this cemetery. But there was one
as we walked round that stood out, and that was a lad from the Manchester Regiment, and there was a picture of him, and there was a picture of his mother standing by the original wooden cross, and you wonder what she was thinking. That must have only been about 1920 before the commission put in place the Portland headstones. And then we've often said, haven't we, during this trip, imagine then seeing both parents and the soldier himself behind the grave, and then the extended family. Yeah. Is that what's been passing through your mind?
Yeah, it has. And just before, when you played the last post, as we were sitting here, I was thinking, you know, imagine if you could see the soldier himself, the families, the mum, the dad, the brothers, the sisters, the wives, the children. It would be packed. And this is just a small corner. And I also think, I wonder whether if these men knew that all these years later, we would be here and we would remember them and that they are not forgotten. And, you know, I hope that they would be proud.
And their parents as well.
Yeah.
Because especially from your country and from New Zealand and South Africa, Canada, the families would not, it would have been impossible for them to come, wouldn't it?
Yeah, very few actually were able to afford to come across and see the grave of their relatives. So, yeah, for us, there's also a representation of our homeland and the many, many people that weren't able to do it. And, you know, I find that to be a privilege and an honour, you know, not from just my own. We've seen the grave of Susan's great-great-great-grandfather, and we've seen where he was killed and so forth, and we've seen the story of my ancestor. But, you know, we have an obligation, I think, to also honour these people, because their relatives haven't had the chance
We're representing your relatives who perhaps didn't get the chance.
Yeah.
And Susan, your great-great-great-grandfather, was it?
Yes.
His name was William Wallace, which is a very famous name in history. But he was killed on Hill 60 in May of 1915 in the terrible battles that happened there. And on that day, 14 men died, and he's the only one to have a grave at Spoilbank Cemetery. So how much did you know about him before you came here?
Not very much at all. I knew he was Wallace because my granny, that's his daughter, she was Victoria Wallace before she married my granddad. But she was actually born at the end of January, and he died in May. So he knew that she'd been born, but they never met, obviously. And she had an older sister, just 12 months older. And then her mother, as a widow, went on to marry and then had another large extended family with the Elliots. So over in Northern Ireland, where my family's from, and that's where my dad was from, it's his mum, I've never really heard them talk about him at all. So it was only through my auntie and my sister who'd started to do some digging in ancestry that we sort of discovered a bit more about him. So, and I think as far as we know, we're the first direct descendants to visit his grave.
And also go to where he actually died.
Where he actually died, yeah.
To locate the precise location.
Yeah. And we did come here in 2018, and we were here with our two children. And I just remember at that time it was very cold, and it was April, and we were just at the grave thinking, this is unbelievable. There's five generations connected here. For my children, me, my dad, my grandma, and her father. And that was pretty incredible.
So a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity.
Absolutely. Yeah. Really special.
And then what's going to happen now then? You're going to return to Australia, you're going to set up a film show, and you're going to tell all your friends.
Yeah, exactly. They've got no hope.
I don't know what's going to hit them.
Oh, no. They know. We've got two little niece and nephew. Michael's talking about the war again. Look out. This is going to be, you know, we've got so much material now, so it's going to be a lot of fun.
And then we've had a local guide took us around Tynecott, Johan de Jong. And then we've been to the tank at Pond Farm. I forgot what the farm was called then. So we've had you've met quite a lot of local people as well, haven't you?
It's amazing. And the knowledge, you know, people think I know a bit about this stuff, and I meet people like you, Terry, and then the other people that we've met, and it's just for me, because it's such an interest. Like, I could do this for months. Literally could do it for months and not be bored because of all the information. And I just, you know, it's so fascinating and interesting and moving and emotional. There's so much that goes with it. We were even saying last night we were feeling quite tired, yet we hadn't walked a great deal.
It's the emotions.
It's the emotions. You go from the German cemetery cemetery at Langemark where it feels sad and it's heavy. And then you go to the place like Pond Farm and you see a bloke who's building a replica tank and it's, you know, it's full of fun and happiness. Yeah. And I think the emotions of it, you know, can be really tiring in one sense as well.
Exhausted. Yeah. I must say, whenever I return from a family tour, especially when we come over, for a couple of days afterwards I go home and I'm almost brain dead. No one can get any sense out of me, which is no surprise to anyone that knows me. But as we were playing the last post then and we looked out, it was amazing. We're sitting here, four of us are sitting here, and we're all having different thoughts as we look out across the Ypres Reservoir cemetery. And my eyes were fixed on the Stone of Remembrance. And Kipling's words on there, there's one single British Legion wreath below it, and it just says, "Their name liveth forevermore." And I think that really sums up what we've come to do and why you've travelled all around the world.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, when Kipling said those words, you know, maybe they were aspirational, maybe he wasn't sure whether that was something that would actually turn out to be true. But as you said, Terry, that's why we're here, and their name will live forevermore, because they deserve for their name to live forevermore. And whilst there's people like us, and I think there's lots and lots of people like us, and there always will be, then, you know, people will continue to come and remember. And, you know, it's such an honour to be able to do that.
Because although we joke about telling your family, your kids came out here in 2018, was it? Mm-hmm. Therefore, they've got that knowledge, and hopefully one day they'll bring their kids here.
Oh, yeah, for sure. And, you know, we've also taken our children to Gallipoli for the same purpose. And, yeah, while they tease me quite a bit, at the same time they understand, you know, and they are also, you know, in their way, proud of the fact that we have people within our family or within our nation that we can remember and honour for such an amazing thing to do, such an amazing sacrifice. And, you know, you just think, how did all of these people, how did they do it? And I often think, I don't think I could have. Mm-hmm. And that's, to me, one of the other reasons why it's great to remember them, you know. So.
And the strange thing is that what's brought us here in the first place, how on earth did I come across two people from the other side of the world? When we started doing Tales from the Podcast, one of the things that we wanted to do was to bring to life the stories that no one's heard about. And that's how you came across me, wasn't it? By listening to the podcast?
Yeah, I've been listening to different military history podcasts for some time, particularly over COVID when a number of them started. And then one day when I was just looking to see if I could find a new one, because sometimes you get to the end of the episodes and you're looking for another one, Tales from the Battlefields pops up. And I think at that stage, Terry, you'd done 6 or 7 episodes. I listened to the first two, and you said in your first one, if people continue to listen, then I'll keep doing it. So I thought, all right, I'll send you an email and say, well, I'll be listening, so you may as well keep doing it. And then we just got in touch from there, and here we are. And we've just had the best 3 days, you know, that I could
have. Rewarding.
Yeah, it has.
Thank you very much. And obviously, if anybody else wants to make the same journey, wherever you live in the world, please do get in touch, and I'm sure it's something that we can arrange. So have a safe journey back and enjoy the rest of your time here in Belgium.
Yeah, I would just like to say, if you do want to do something like this with Terry, by all means, get on and do it, because it's really, really good. It's been brilliant.
You only live once.
That is right.
So once again, I'd like you to thank you for tuning in to my podcast, Tales from the Battlefields. There'll be another one along in about 10 days, 12 days' time. And as usual, I'd like to pay tribute to the two soldiers that we've talked about in detail during this podcast, William Wallace and Henry Osborne. And we're going to do that by playing The Last Post.